The evidence is overwhelming.
Billions of years.
Science has settled this.
But has it really?
He's a double major, physics and astronomy, holding a PhD in astrophysics from the same universities that teach what he now dismantles. He's also a published author, a Fortis Fellow, and a Christian who believes the Bible means exactly what it says. This is In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Is the Earth really 4.5 billion years old, or is it only a few thousand years old? And what does the science indicate? Hi folks, I'm Dr. Jason Lyle, an astrophysicist with Fortis Institute, and today we want to answer this question, what about the scientific evidence for the age of the Earth? In a previous segment, we showed that the Bible teaches that God really did create in six literal days, and that this was a few thousand years ago, and that God created the universe and everything that's in it within that span of 6 days. But today, we're taught that science has established that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and the universe is even older at 13 billion years. And we've been taught that the science proves this, that we can, by measuring radioactive particles in rocks, we can determine their age. Well, that's not really the case, but in order to understand this issue, I want to give a little bit of the historical background. You see, up until the 1600s, it was well known, at least among the Christian community, that the Earth was a few thousand years old. Most scientists at that time were Christians, and they used the revelation from God's Word to guide their scientific thinking, and they were very successful in drawing conclusions. For example, they recognized that most of the top sedimentary layers, rock layers on the Earth, were deposited by the global flood, with a few afterwards, of course. And that made sense. It made sense of the fossils that we find in rock layers, the fact that we find marine fossils on the highest mountaintops. Yes, even Mount Everest has marine fossils at the top. That makes sense in light of the global flood. But beginning in the 1600s and well into the 1700s, there were some people who began challenging those ideas. And they began thinking that rather than the flood being responsible for all this geology, that perhaps there was no worldwide flood, and instead these rock layers had been deposited gradually over hundreds of millions of years. Now, this idea that Earth's major features were formed gradually under the kinds of conditions we see today is called uniformitarianism. Now, that is a philosophy. It is not a scientific conclusion. It's a philosophical lens through which many people began interpreting the data. And so they challenged the notion of a global flood and began arguing that the Earth was much older than the Bible teaches because it would take millions of years at today's slow rates to deposit the kinds of rock layers that we see on Earth today. This paved the way for Darwinian evolution in 1859 when Darwin published his book. It would have been immediately rejected if everybody agreed that the Earth's a few thousand years old. After all, it would be ridiculous to turn a frog into a prince in a very short period of time. That's a fairy tale. But given the idea of millions of years, it seems like almost anything can happen. And so the idea of deep time, that you know, the idea that the Earth's millions of years old, really paved the way for Darwinian evolution. And by the way, evolutionists will never give up deep time. They'll never give up the idea of millions of years because they need it in order for evolution to sound plausible. Now, I would argue that evolution is not plausible even in billions of years, but my point is they need the millions of years to make evolution sound reasonable. And so the idea of millions of years based on uniformitarianism was well in place before anyone began trying to argue that that was a scientific necessity or that it was something that the scientific evidence indicated. And frankly, most processes on Earth that we know about don't give anywhere near millions of years, even if you make very generous assumptions about their origins. For example, tree rings would never lead you to believe that the ecosystem is billions of years old, or the rate at which salt accumulates in the ocean doesn't get you anywhere near billions of years. It wasn't until the discovery of radioactivity that scientists began using that as a method to establish the age of rocks. The method is called radiometric dating, and a lot of people have misconceptions about it. They sort of have the impression that you just pick up a rock, you scan it with your tricorder, and it measures the age of it somehow. Well, that's not really what's happening. What's really being measured are radioisotope ratios, and that takes a little bit of explanation. Certain atoms are unstable. You know, we're all made of atoms, these little particles that have protons and neutrons in the nucleus and electrons circling around. Now, most atoms are stable, which means they will remain the same kind of atom forever. But certain atoms are unstable or radioactive, which means they will spontaneously change into another type of atom. For example, uranium-238 will spontaneously change into thorium-234. You don't have to do anything to it. You wait a little while, and each uranium atom will spontaneously change into thorium-234, emitting energy as it does so. And that's what we call radioactivity. Now, fortunately, only a small fraction of atoms do this. But there are some of these radioactive atoms in rocks. And the neat thing is we know the rate at which uranium changes into thorium. We can measure that today, and it's very, very slow. It happens atom by atom, and you don't know which atom is going to change next. It's kind of like popcorn in the microwave. You don't know which kernel is going to pop next, but you do know that after about 2.5 minutes, they've all popped. It's the same way with uranium-238. You don't know which atom's going to change next, but you do know that after a certain amount of time, a certain fraction of them will have changed or decayed into thorium-234. Thorium-234 is also radioactive and will decay into protactinium, which will decay into radium-234, which decays into thorium-230, and so on, all the way down to lead-206. And lead-206 is stable, so once you reach that stage, it will remain lead-206 forever. Now, since we can measure the rate at which this happens today, we can calculate how long it would take for a chunk of uranium-238 for all of it to decay into lead-206. And it turns out it's a very long time. Indeed, it's billions of years. And so if we find a rock that has some uranium-238 in it and some lead-206, it's very tempting to try and compute the age of the rock by figuring out how long it took that uranium to decay into the lead. But that raises an interesting question. How do we know that all the lead in that rock came from the uranium, that it's a decay byproduct? Maybe when the rock formed, it already had some lead in it. And so you see, one of the assumptions of radiometric dating in trying to use that to gauge the age of a rock is that you know the initial ratio of uranium-238 to lead-206. But since we weren't around when the rock formed, we can't really know that. Now, scientists have figured out clever ways to try and estimate that. There are what are called isochron methods, and these are very clever, but they are guesses as to the original ratio of parent-to-daughter elements. In other words, how do you know I didn't make that rock yesterday in a laboratory and I already had a lot of lead-206 in it to begin with? I could fool you. I could make a rock with the right radioactive elements in it, and I could make you conclude that its age is anything I want it to be, even though its true age is zero, because I just made it yesterday. So you see, radiometric dating doesn't actually measure the age of anything. It measures isotope ratios and then uses that to draw a conclusion about the most probable age of a rock based on certain assumptions. And by the way, one of those assumptions is that the rate at which these elements decay has always been the same throughout Earth history, and there's good evidence that it hasn't been. By analogy, you can think of the uranium-238 decaying into lead-206 a bit like an hourglass, the sand going from the top chamber into the bottom chamber. That's like uranium going to lead, it's the sand going from the top chamber to the bottom chamber. Now, you can use an hourglass to tell time, but only if you make certain assumptions. If when you first walked into a room and you saw an hourglass and it was about halfway done, and I asked you, how long ago do you think that hourglass got turned over? You might say, well, it looks like it's about a halfway done, and it's an hourglass. I'd say about a half an hour. And I'd say, oh, I gotcha, because in fact, I turned it over 1 minute ago, but already a lot of the sand was in the bottom chamber. See, you assumed that all the sand was in the top chamber, when in fact, that is not the case. And it's the same way in a rock. You don't know the initial ratio of parent to daughter elements, and so you don't really know the age of the rock. So there are three main assumptions that are made when we estimate the age of a rock using radiometric dating. One, that we know the initial ratio of elements, which we never really know for certain. Two, that the decay rate has always been constant. And three, that the system is closed in the sense that no material has moved in and out of the rock. Now, if any one of those is wrong, you're going to get the wrong age. And there is very good evidence that that second assumption is dead wrong. The RATE research group, which was a group of many PhD physicists and geologists that have a creation worldview, they came together and did some wonderful research showing that there's good evidence that in the past, radioactive decay rates were much faster than they are today. And so if you don't compensate for that, your estimated ages will be far older than the true age. And this might account for why secularists believe that rocks are much older than we know from Scripture that they really are. But we know radiometric dating is not reliable because we've tested it on rocks of known age. When Mount St. Helens erupted in the 1980s, and it erupted more than once, but we collected some brand new rocks that had formed from the magma, and we sent them into secular labs and had them estimate the age, and those rocks came out with estimated ages of hundreds of thousands to even millions of years on rocks that we know are brand new. So the bottom line is, radiometric dating has been shown to not work on rocks of known age, and yet secularists assume that it works on rocks of unknown age. And that is not logical. After a short break, we'll look at some of the lines of evidence that show that the Earth is much younger than billions of years.
And we'll be back with more from Dr. Jason Lyle in just a moment, who's pulled back the curtain on radiometric dating and the assumptions baked into it. Here's the thing that nobody tells you about content like this. It's expensive to make. It's also easy to lose. What does that mean? Well, a working astrophysicist taking the time to explain the things that he's explaining, decay rates and all of those things in plain English, in a way that an ordinary person can follow along, look, that's rare. And it also doesn't fund itself. What keeps this going is a group of people, a quiet group of people, just ordinary men and women from all over the world who believe in the mission of Fortis Institute so much that they wanted to make sure that more people in more places have access to this content. We call them Gospel Partners. And they believe that the next generation deserves to hear science explained by someone who actually believes the Bible. If so, if you've benefited by anything you've heard here at Fortis Institute, especially from Dr. Lyle's mind, joining us as a gospel partner is how you keep it working for someone else. Before I give you the website, there are a couple of caveats to joining us as a gospel partner. Number one, we don't want you to join us as a gospel partner if you're not already giving to your local church. That's your number one giving priority as a Christian, so make sure that's an area of your life that is looking good and is in order. Also, we don't want you to join us as a gospel partner if it would be a burden for you. We don't want to be a burden on anyone, so make sure those two areas of your life are in order. And if they are, and you could and would and want to join us as a gospel partner, you can get details right now about what that would look like at fortisinstitute.org. And while you're out there on the internet hopping around, there's an app, and it is for free. It's Fortis Plus. That's our distribution hub. Maybe you're listening to In the Beginning on Fortis Plus right now, or maybe you've not even heard of it yet. Make sure that you download it on your smartphone or your smart TV, because Fortis Plus is full of hundreds of hours of audio and video content from every fellow here at Fortis Institute. That is Dr. Jason Lyle. Of course, that also includes Dr. Greg Gifford, Dr. Adam Tyson, Dr. John Krotz, Pastor Brad Bigney, Libby Glosson, and Todd Friel. Download it right now. You can do it on your smartphone, your smart TV, or you can just simply go to fortisplus.org. Now let's get back to Dr. Jason Lyle. This is In the Beginning.
For me, when I study the universe, I'm studying the handiwork of God. I don't know how secular people do it. I don't know how they can enjoy something that they think is just chance.
And now back to In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Well, before the break, we looked at radiometric dating and showed that it's based on certain assumptions, and we know that one or more of those assumptions are wrong because we've tested radiometric dating on rocks whose age we know, and it often gives very inflated ages. But what about carbon dating? A lot of people mistakenly think that carbon dating is what secularists use to get the millions of years, but it isn't. In fact, carbon dating tends to be much more reliable. It's not perfect either, but when we test it on things of known age, it tends to give the right answer, or at least within the ballpark. Now, carbon dating is similar to radiometric dating, except it's based on C14, which is a radioactive variety of carbon. Most carbon is C12 because it has 6 protons and 6 neutrons in the nucleus, but there's a variety called C14 that has 2 extra neutrons, which makes it unstable, radioactive. C14 will spontaneously decay into nitrogen, and it does so on a time scale of what we call a half-life of 5,730 years. And so, in other words, it doesn't take millions of years for C14 to change into nitrogen. C14 is created in the upper atmosphere when cosmic rays strike nitrogen atoms, bombarding them and converting them into C14, and then over time they'll decay back. But in the meantime, some of that carbon that's in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide is absorbed by plants. Plants release the oxygen for us to breathe, and then they take that carbon and use that to build plant, basically. And then animals come along and eat the plants, or we eat the plants, or we eat the animals that eat the plants. And so some of that carbon is used to build our body. So animals and humans have a small fraction of C14 in our bodies that we've picked up by eating plants that have absorbed that C14 from the atmosphere. So a small fraction of the carbon in you is C14. Now, it's not a large fraction. In fact, it's only about one atom in a trillion, but nonetheless, it's there. And that C14, over the course of time, will decay back into nitrogen. And so you might think you'd be losing C14, but you're not, because you continue to eat foods that have C14 in them that they've gained from plants, that have gained from the atmosphere. And so while you're alive, the C14 to C12 ratio in you is about the same as it is in the environment, because you continue to replace it. But then at some point, an animal or a human dies, it no longer eats, it no longer breathes, and so the C14 is no longer replaced, it simply decays away. And so the idea is, by measuring the C14 to C12 ratio in the remains of an animal, you can actually tell how long ago it died. Now, of course, that's based on certain assumptions as well. It's based on the assumption that the C14 in the atmosphere has been constant over time. But nonetheless, we find that when we use this method to estimate the age of something whose true age we know, it tends to give the right answer, or at least within the right ballpark. And the neat thing is, it never gives millions or billions of years, even on things that evolutionists believe to be very old, like coal beds. Coal is supposed to be hundreds of millions of years old, and yet every chunk of coal we've ever tested has C14 in it. And that tells you it can't be anywhere near millions of years old. In fact, if the entire Earth were nothing but C14, after 1 million years, you'd not have a single atom left if there weren't any regeneration sources. C14 doesn't last that long. And so the fact that we have found C14 in dinosaur remains shows that dinosaurs are not millions of years old. We found C14 in diamonds that evolutionists believe to be 1 to 2 billion years old, but they can't be because they have C14 in them, and it simply doesn't last that long. And then the secularists have said, well, there must be some kind of contamination, some way of getting new C14 in there. But how would you do that with a diamond? It's the hardest substance. There doesn't seem to be any way to do that. Nor can other radiometric sources recharge the C14 because there aren't enough of them. You'd need 13,000 times more radioactive productivity in the Earth to recharge the C14. It's just not feasible. And so the fact that we find C14 in just about everything that has carbon in it tells us the entire Earth is nowhere near millions of years old. It's only a few thousand years old. And a lot of people don't realize that there are many processes like that. Many processes that, even if we assume, for the sake of argument, the uniformitarian assumption of constant rates in the past, nonetheless will give a contradictory answer, an answer that does not line up with the 4.5 billion years. For example, the rate at which salt flows into the ocean. Even freshwater has a little bit of salt in it. Rivers pick up a little bit of salt from the continents, and they dump that salt into the ocean at a rate of 450 million tons per year. Now, the water in the ocean evaporates, but it leaves the salt. And so the oceans actually get a little bit saltier every year. You can get rid of a little bit of that salt with salt sprays and things like that, but that only gets rid of 27% maximum, and so the other 73% simply accumulates. And so the oceans are actually getting saltier and saltier over time. And if you do the calculation based on today's rates, it puts the maximum possible age of the ocean between 30 and 40 million years. Even being generous to the critics, the oceans would have to be less than 62 million years old. And you'd say, well, that sounds like a lot, but that's the maximum possible age, because if you run it back that far, the ocean would be freshwater, and you can't go back further than that because you can't have less salt than no salt. And so what that does is it means the maximum possible age of the ocean would be 62 million years, and yet the secular views require that the ocean's 3 billion years old. That doesn't work, but it's perfectly consistent with the biblical age of about 6,000 years, knowing that God made the oceans with salt already in them. There's a similar issue with the rate at which mud accumulates on the ocean floor. Again, rivers wash out mud into the ocean floor at a rate of about 20 billion tons per year. And the mud simply accumulates. There's really no way to get rid of it, except maybe plate tectonics, which can get rid of a maximum of 1 billion tons per year, leaving the other 19 billion tons to simply accumulate. Now, again, assuming for the sake of hypothesis, the uniformitarian assumption of constancy of rates, how long would it take to accumulate the current amount of mud on the ocean floor? Less than 12 million years. But that's inconsistent with the secular view that the oceans are 3 billion years old. And so you see, it's a problem, but it's not a problem if they're a few thousand years old, because we would expect the worldwide flood would have dumped a lot of mud on the ocean floor very quickly. We would reject uniformitarianism. Human population is another problem for millions of years, because you see, humans reproduce quickly, and even starting out a few thousand years ago, you can easily get Earth's current population of between 7 and 8 billion people. It's not a problem. But if the human race went back 100,000 years or more, as evolutionists believe, then the Earth should be completely full of people, but it isn't. That even includes the fact that there were greater mortality rates in the past and so on. We do have to take those factors into consideration. But it is virtually impossible to maintain a 0% growth rate for hundreds of thousands of years. It just doesn't work. The record of human population growth is consistent with the biblical timescale. The rate at which the Earth's magnetic field is decaying is consistent with its biblical timescale of a few thousand years. We know that the energy in Earth's magnetic field is dropping with time. We'd expect that because magnetic fields are caused by electrical current in the core, and electrical current encounters resistance and therefore runs down with time. Just like a battery, the Earth's magnetic field is draining with time, and we can measure that. We've been able to measure that for the last century and a half, and we know it's decaying. And if you use the current decay rate, assuming an exponential decay, which is what we'd expect for this type of phenomenon, and you run the equation back 6,000 years, the Earth's magnetic field would have been 20 times stronger than it is today. And that's fine. But if you run it back even 60,000 years, not millions of years, but 60,000, the magnetic field would have been stronger than that of a neutron star. And that's enough to rip the atoms of your body apart. And so that limits the age of the Earth to much less than the 4.5 billion years that secularists think they need in order to make evolution sound plausible. Did you know the moon is actually spiraling away from the Earth at a rate of about an inch and a half a year? Now, over 6,000 years, that doesn't add up to very much. It's about 750 feet, so the moon hasn't regressed very far, given that it's 240,000 miles away. But if the Earth were billions of years old, this would be a huge problem. See, the moon spirals away because of tidal forces. It induces tides on Earth's oceans, and since the Earth rotates faster than the moon orbits, those tidal bulges pull ahead on the moon, which gives it energy and causes it to move away from the Earth at a rate of about an inch and a half a year. Now, if we do the math properly, we have to realize that in the past, the moon would have been closer to the Earth, and therefore the tidal bulges would have been bigger, and so the rate would have been faster. It goes as 1 over r to the sixth, where r is the distance between the Earth and the moon. And so if you do that calculation properly, you'll find that, again, assuming that the tidal breaking constant hasn't changed, that the Earth and Moon would have been in the same place at the same time 1.45 billion years in a hypothetical past. And of course, that's absurd. They can't be in the same place at the same time. That's a maximum possible age of the Earth and Moon. And you'd say, well, that's pretty big, 1.45 billion years. Yeah, but secularists believe the Earth and Moon to be about 4.5 billion years old. And so the data simply are not consistent with that. And there are lots of processes like this. Now, don't get me wrong, I reject uniformitarianism. But my point is, even if I accept it for the sake of argument, we still get many lines of evidence that show that the Earth is much younger than the 4.5 billion years needed for evolution to sound plausible. And so the data are consistent with what the Bible teaches. Thanks for listening. God bless.
This has been In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, a production of Fortis Institute. Our website is fortisinstitute.org, and it is your central hub for all things Fortis. If you've enjoyed In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, consider subscribing and sharing with your friends and church family. Also, would you prayerfully consider joining this labor of love by becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner? And until next time, go serve your King.